You may recall that 1 Samuel 17 might be one of the more famous passages in the Old Testament. It is the that dead giveaway for a Sunday school class, David versus Goliath. Well, Goliath is dead and there's been a great victory. Chapter 18. Now when he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. Saul took him that day and would not let him go home to his father's house anymore. Then Jonathan and David made a covenant because he loved him as his own soul. And Jonathan took off the robe that was on him and gave it to David with his armor, even to the sword, to his sword and his bow and his belt. So David went out wherever Saul sent him and behaved wisely. And Saul set him over the men of war, and he was accepted in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servants. Now it happened, as they were coming home, when David was returning from the slaughter of the Philistines, that the women had come out of all the cities of Israel singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tambourines, with joy, and with musical instruments. So the women sang as they danced and said, "Saul has slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s." Then Saul was very angry, and the saying displeased him, and he said, "They have ascribed to David 10,000s, and to me have ascribed only thousands. Now what more can he have but the kingdom?" So Saul eyed David from that day forward. And it happened on the next day that the distressing spirit from God came upon Saul, and he prophesied inside the house. So David played music with his hand as at other times, but there was a spear in Saul's hand. And David cast the spear, for he said, "I will pin David to the wall." But David escaped his presence twice. Now Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him, but had departed from Saul. Therefore Saul removed him from his presence and made him captain over 1,000, and he went out and came in before the people. And David behaved wisely in all his ways, and the Lord was with him. Therefore when Saul saw that he behaved very wisely, he was afraid of him. But all Israel and Judah loved David because he went out and came in before them. Last week, we talked about this horrific thing called envy. This morning, we're going to continue with that theme. I said we would go on to the next verses there in James, but we're going to stay where we were in James. And let's go to James and read our passage, and then I want to come back to the passage we just read. James chapter 3. Who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom. But if you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, do not boast and lie against the truth. This wisdom does not descend from above, but is earthly, sensual, demonic. For where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. Now the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. I will tell you that this study on envy that I've been doing here as I preach through this has been a surprise, I'll say. I've been surprised by it. I never really realized how destructive envy is. And part of the problem with envy is it feels so good at the time, does it not? What are we going to do with something called envy that is completely destructive, that at the time often feels like justice? What do we do with something like that? Last week we saw the fountain of envy, Genesis 3, there in the garden. The serpent got nothing out of it. Eve got nothing out of it, really. But somehow, the serpent got her to be envious of God. "You shall be like God, Eve." We saw the future of envy, which is destruction and death in Proverbs 10. And we saw the failure of envy in James chapter 3, how it destroys everything good. And this was our definition. Envy is wanting something you are not supposed to have, even while having so much more than you deserve, and often enough, more than what others have. It includes wanting to destroy the property and happiness of others. And it came up in the questions last week, and this always comes up. Is envy, you know, driving past the, past the appliance store and wanting a new dishwasher or anything, lawnmower, whatever, and wanting that. Of course, we talked about the fact that envy, real envy, is always directed towards someone else and wanting to destroy that person. And envy really is not based on getting something else so that my life is better, but it's usually based on destroying what someone else has to make their life worse. It doesn't really matter if my life gets better when it comes to envy, as long as his life or my neighbor's life is somehow worse. Again, wanting something you are not supposed to have, even while having so much more than you deserve, and often enough more than what others have. It includes wanting to destroy the property and happiness of others. This morning, we will see that envy opposes everything good. That is, envy is not compatible with wisdom from above. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. What would you do? What would you do with something that destroys three things primarily? One, life. Number two, reputation. And number three, peace. Let's say it was a person or a thing or an idea. What would you do to destroy that? Now listen here. We quarantine people who spread disease, do we not? Do we not do that? This week I took a day off from work because I was coughing. I could tell some of my, and I'm on the phone, that's my job. I could tell that some of my colleagues were not real happy with me coughing all the time. They were afraid that they would get what I got. I think it's more of an allergy thing, but anyway. But we do that, right? When people came over across the water from Europe, oftentimes they were quarantined for a while just to make sure they weren't spreading some disease. That's what we do. How do you quarantine envy? What does disease do? Well, disease actually attacks two out of three. I said three things. Life, reputation, and peace. Envy destroys those three. Disease only really destroys two of those, right? It destroys life and peace. It doesn't really destroy reputation. But for many, reputation is actually more precious to them than life and peace. But how do you quarantine envy? And do you think I am overstating the case here? Is envy really that bad? You see, if we could recognize it the way it really is, maybe we would go to war against it like we go to war against diseases. But again, I tell you this morning that envy so often feels like justice. Just like it felt like justice to Saul. We'll look at that in just a moment. But listen to this in the meantime. Listen to the destructive nature of envy. And yes, I am saying this morning that the most universally destructive force in the world is not nuclear bombs, is not war as we know it, is not even mosquitoes, as good as it felt last night to kill two of them in a row. Just felt so good. It's not even them, it's envy. I'm going to try to make that case this morning. Let's see what envy does. The death of Christ. For Pilate knew that they had handed him over because of envy. Now, we're going to talk about this a little bit more this morning. But Already this morning in the Nicene Creed and earlier in the Apostles' Creed, it's an odd thing that Pontius Pilate shows up in both of those creeds. It's an interesting thing. What's Pilate doing in our creeds? I think one of the reasons may be that out of all the people that figured out what was really going on when Christ was crucified, oddly enough, it wasn't all these theologically trained scribes, Pharisees, and so forth. Levites. They were the ones who were so deep in envy themselves they couldn't see the forest for the trees at all. It was Pilate who figured out what was going on. He says, again, Matthew 27:18, he knew that they had handed him over because of envy. Mark says the same thing. He knew that the chief priests, the ones, the most theologically trained ones in the whole place, the chief priests, had handed him over because of envy. Mark 15:10. Acts 13:45. But when the Jews saw the multitudes, they were filled with envy. And what did they do next? Go home and have a TV dinner? No. Envy always acts. And envy always destroys. The Jews saw the multitudes, they were filled with envy, and contradicting and blaspheming, they opposed the things spoken by Paul. And of course, then someone got themselves hurt. Romans 1:29, being filled with all unrighteousness, sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy. And right after envy, guess what? This sounds like James. Right after Paul mentions envy, he mentions murder, strife, deceit, evil-mindedness, they are whisperers. Does that not sound like what James just said? Confusion and every evil work as a result of this envy thing. Paul, going to battle with the Corinthians, says this: for you are still carnal. For where there is envy, strife, and divisions among you, are you not carnal and behaving like mere men? Paul there saying to the Corinthians, you have envy. And with it, strife and divisions. Again, does that sound like James? You're behaving like mere men. 1 Timothy, talking about those who oppose the ministry. Talking about those who are proud, knowing nothing, but obsessed with disputes and arguments over words. You know anything? You know anyone like this? Does this ring any bells at all? Let me read it again. He is proud, knowing nothing, but is obsessed with disputes and arguments over words, which come from sound theological training. No. 1 Timothy 6:4. Which come from envy, strife, reviling, evil suspicions. Sounds again like James, does it not? Titus 3:3. For we ourselves were once foolish, disobedient, deceived, serving various lusts and pleasures, living in malice and envy, hating one another. Do you think I'm overstating the case? Am I overstating the case when I say that envy is a universally destructive force? It just destroys everything. Again, whatever it was, if envy could be personified as a person or as an idea or whatever, and we could see it, and we know it would just destroy everything that was precious, what would we do to destroy it? And yet it comes clothed in justice, clothed in good feelings, clothed in something that we want to play with, that we want to entertain. Oh, we may know it's wrong, but it just feels so good at the time. My neighbor doesn't deserve these things. And let's see how it worked out this morning in the lives of a few folks that we're going to look at in the Bible. But before we do that, just one more verse here that I skipped. Galatians 5:19-23. Now the works of the flesh are evident, which are adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lewdness, idolatry, sorcery, hatred, contentions, jealousies, outbursts of wrath, selfish ambitions, dissensions, heresies, envy, murders, drunkenness. Once again, envy placed right beside murder. We will see this morning that envy was at the base of murder of people and reputations. Envy is not always put exactly beside murder, but it is often enough in the scriptures it is. Then that's contrasted, of course, with the fruit of the Spirit being love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Again, that sounds like what James is talking about, does it not? Now let's illustrate here from the Bible illustrations of what we're talking about. Let's go back again to Genesis chapter 3 and 4. And we're going to see this envy thing is a consistent theme in the first two examples of sin in the Bible. We saw last week that it was envy that brought the brought the temptation home to Eve. You shall be like God. Who is God to hold back from you? Who is he to tell you what you can and can't eat? Eve then looks at the tree and she says, well, it's good for something. It's good for food. It's pleasant. She eats it. And Eve, as a result of her envy, gains nothing and loses much, we saw. But it doesn't stop there. Genesis chapter 4. Let's look at this. Again, we have said that envy gets into us here and it attacks our neighbor and does nothing for us except to make bring down our neighbor. We don't rise at all, but our neighbor gets destroyed, and somehow that's a good thing. My friends, I get so frustrated myself. This is just a side. If I'll just say this, I'll move on. I get so frustrated when I say that the Christian religion is just like everything else. It burns a hole in my head. Because I want to tell you something. You name for me any other religion that deals so thoroughly with this problem of envy. Name it for me. Not in atheism. Not in Buddhism. Not in Islam. And I would tell you that most of these religions, and most, if not all, and most of these isms are based on envy. They wouldn't exist if there was no such thing as envy. Socialism, as we've said before, based entirely on envy. And it is the Bible itself that goes to war against envy, like no other religion that I know of at all, quite frankly. We must embrace what the Bible has to say about this destructive force, and we must go to war against it every place we can. Look at the destruction that it engenders from the very beginning. We have this example of Cain and Abel, and we have it commented on in the New Testament, and we'll look at that in a moment. Adam knew his wife. She conceived and bore Cain and said, I have acquired a man from the Lord. She is happy to have him for various reasons. This is Genesis 4. Then she bore again, this time his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. And the process of time it came to pass that Cain brought an offering of the fruit of the ground to the Lord. And Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat. And the Lord respected Abel and his offering. But he did not respect Cain and his offering. And Cain was very angry and his countenance fell. Now, so far, so bad. Who's Cain angry at right now? Well, it seems like he's angry at God because God just talked to him. Cain didn't like what God had to say. And Cain's angry. Okay. So the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry? And why is your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin lies at the door. And its desire is for you, but you shall rule over it. Now Cain talked with Abel his brother, and it came to pass, when they were in the field, that Cain rose up against Abel his brother and killed him. Question. How much better off was Cain now? Cain has now improved his lot in life, has he not? Why, check it out. He was angry that God did not accept his sacrifice. So he did the logical thing. He went out and killed Abel. And now God will for sure accept his sacrifice, right? Can you believe this made sense to Cain at the time? My friends, do we understand this thing called envy? Do we get it? Now, there's an unusual passage in the New Testament. Let's go to it. 1 John 3. Let's check this out. It's a passage that looks like it begs more questions than it answers. 1 John chapter 3. We referenced this last week. John talking about loving one another. In verse 11 he says, "For this is the message that you heard from the beginning, that we should love one another, not as Cain, who was of the wicked one and murdered his brother." Now, John now is going to tell us why he murdered his brother. "I'm glad you asked," John said. John says to his readers, "Why did he do that? Why would you go out and kill your brother?" John tells us, "Because his works were evil and his brother's righteous." But that doesn't quite answer the question, does it? Really? I mean, okay, he murdered his brother because his works were evil and his brothers were righteous, but I think that produces another question, does it not? What? Do you just go out and kill people whose works are righteous and yours aren't? See, I think what John is doing here is he's assuming that we understand the destructive nature of envy. I think John is assuming that we understand it. We get it. People want to destroy others who show them up. And that's what Abel did. Now, Abel didn't go out to show Cain up. But Cain wound up looking bad in comparison with Abel. And so what was the logical thing to do for Cain? Easy answer, my friends. Didn't even have to think about it. Kill Abel. So we see envy from the very beginning resulting in strife, misery, and death. And as we saw both earlier with Eve and Adam, Adam and Eve, especially Eve, if you will, and Adam as well, I believe, based on envy, gained nothing, lost much. Same way with Abel or Cain here. Gained nothing, lost much. Both the same thing. Adam and Eve get thrown out of the Garden of Eden. Cain basically being put a mark, getting a mark put on him and becoming a fugitive throughout the earth. And in both cases, my friends, and I don't have time to elaborate on this, and I it would take a lot of work, but in both cases of envy here, in the very beginning, in the case of Adam and Eve, in the case of Cain, it's almost as if nature itself, the earth itself, hated these envious people. And I think there's something to that, because if it's true that envy produces strife and every evil work, then the earth itself will be plagued. Those people will become a plague themselves in the earth. And they'll destroy everything good and everything right. Which is one of the reasons why in countries that are driven by envy, socialistic countries, we see confusion, all kinds of evil works going on. And we see the earth under a curse in these cases. Great pollution. Yeah, I mean, you ever see that? You ever do a little study on that? We have all kinds of Earth First people here in the West. and all kinds of people are concerned about the environment and so forth. I notice that many of these people are not concerned about the environment in socialistic countries where they have real pollution. I mean, have you ever seen some of these pictures of some of these different towns in China, for example? Have you seen this? Where everybody's out there with a mask over their faces to breathe? This envy thing is at the bottom of my attacking my neighbor's person and property. And we need to go to war against them. We can't see these isms, especially socialism, as just another idea. We need to see it for the wickedness that it is. And we have no excuse for not seeing the wickedness that it is, because the Bible is very clear on this. Cain versus Abel, our first illustration. Second illustration, Joseph, Genesis chapter 37. My message this morning is that envy gets you nothing but trouble. Even though it feels so good at the time, it feels right. Right, kids? Yeah, now we're going to talk to the kids. We're going to talk to 12 kids. 11 of them felt really pretty good about their envy. Doing nothing for them. Yeah. Genesis chapter 37. This is just pure good old-fashioned envy in action. What's it look like? Jacob dwelt in the land, 37:1, where his father was estranged in the land of Canaan. Verse 3. Now, Jacob, or Israel, loved Joseph more than all his children, because he was a son of his old age, and he made him a tunic of many colors. I'll stop there for a minute. Most people blame Jacob for this. And being a Jacobophile myself, I have a hard time listening to it. However, you know, he calls him the son of his old age, and I think it was because he was Rachel's son as well, who he really did love. There's a special place in his heart for Joseph. And it didn't help the situation at all. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. Now, what's happening here? The father has made a favorite of his son. The problem, what's Joseph going to do at this point, right? At this point, okay? Remember that they hated Joseph before he had his dreams. They hated Joseph because his father loved him prior to the dreams. Now, the dreams didn't help, as we'll see in a moment. So what do? They direct their antipathy towards Joseph, not towards Jacob. Jacob's out of reach. They're not going to do that with Jacob. But they hate Joseph. This is envy getting started here. Let's see where it winds up. When his brothers saw their father loved him, they hated him more. Verse 5, Joseph had a dream, and he told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. So he said to them, "Please hear this dream that I have dreamed. There we were, bending over the sheaves in the field, and behold, my sheaf arose and also stood upright, and indeed your sheaf stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf." And his brothers said to him, "Shall you indeed reign over us, or shall you indeed have dominion over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. So it's the third time they say hated him, then they hated him more, and now he's hated even more in verse 8. And it gets worse. Then he dreamed still another dream and told it to his brothers and said, "Look, I've dreamed another dream, and this time the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowed down to me." So he told it to his father and his brothers. And his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I, your brothers, indeed come to bow down to the earth before you?" And his brothers envied him, but his father kept the matter in mind. (Clears throat) There's our word. Envy. Now, what's going to happen with this envy? Again, do his brothers just take the envy and say, oh, you know what? Envy's just another emotion. You know, like happiness or joy or peace. No. Envy calls for action. That's what we see. Then his brothers went to feed their father's flock in Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, are not your brothers feeding the flock in Shechem? Come, I will send you to them. So he said to them, here I am. And he said to him, please go and see if it is well with your brothers and well with the flocks, and bring back word to me. So he sent him out to the out of the valley of Hebron, and he went to Shechem. Now a certain man found him, and there he was, wandering in the field. And the man said to him, saying, what are you seeking? So he said, I'm seeking my brothers. Please tell me where they are feeding their flocks. The man said, they have departed from here, for I heard them say, let us go to Dothan. So Joseph went after his brothers and found them in Dothan. Now, let's get a little perspective here once again. We're going to see later that Joseph is a faithful man. Jacob is doing what any good businessman will do, right? Jacob can't go and see his brothers. He has a faithful man who will do it. He has someone he can count on. It happens to be his son Joseph. Now, I know a lot of people argue that Joseph should never have told his dream to his brothers and his fathers, but I don't agree with that point. I think he did have to tell them, because later on they figured it out, right? If later on, when they all went down to Egypt, and we know the story, and Joseph then saved them all, and he was their prince, and they did bow down to him, it would not have, the picture would not have been put together properly if Joseph would not have told them the dream to begin with. In any case, we know that Joseph is a faithful man because we know his father can count on him. We knew later that he was very faithful. He was faithful when he was in Potiphar's house. He was faithful when he was in jail. He was faithful when he was in Pharaoh's house. And Jacob, his father, knows he can count on Joseph. Again, I'm not in business myself, but any businessman values faithful people. Businessmen have to know what's really going on out there, right? They have to have an accurate picture. And Jacob can't get an accurate picture of what's going on with his sons unless he has a faithful messenger who will tell him what's going on. And he picks Joseph, because Joseph is exactly that. It's not the fault of Joseph that he was faithful. It's not the fault of Joseph that Jacob could count on him. And it's not the fault of Joseph that Jacob asked him to go check out and see what's going on. And we know he's faithful because we have this little blurb here. A certain man found him wandering in the field. And he said, what are you seeking? And Joseph says, I'm looking for my brothers. Maybe other messengers would come back to Jacob and say, Jacob, you know, I went out and looked for him where you said. They weren't there. So I came home. How many messengers would do that type of a thing? Now, if you're in business, that's not what you need. You need somebody who's going to go out there and find out what's going on and come back and tell you what's happening. And Joseph is that guy. Well, what happens? What happens to this faithful man? What happens to this man who has done nothing to his brothers? And please, you can argue with me about whether or not he should have told his brothers, but you can't argue with me about whether or not they should have killed him for it. Please. Not that. Verse 19. Now when they saw him afar off, even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him. Ah. Working out their envy. Then they said to one another, look, this dreamer is coming. Come therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit. And we shall say, some wild beast has devoured him. And we will see what will become of his dreams. And the story goes on. What's bad about this is that envy just doesn't destroy the object. It destroys so much else. My friends, envy will destroy everything we love. Because what happens here? We don't have time to read it. But it wasn't just Joseph they destroyed, or almost destroyed, sold him into slavery. They had another problem, right? What's Dad going to say? So they figured out, they took his coat, killed a goat, bloodied it up, presented it to Dad, said, I don't know, looks like something happened here that shouldn't have happened. So they destroy Joseph, and in the process, they kind of get even with Dad, don't they? Don't they? It's kind of a brilliant plan. The text doesn't say it, but to me it looks pretty good. It looks brilliant to me. Look what we did. We got rid of Joseph, and also we stuck it back to Dad, who made him a favorite. It really looks at this point like a grand, wonderful plan. My friends, envy will come to us clothed in a good plan, in a good idea, in a fair idea. That's how it comes to us. But it only can come to us if we are proud, as we talked about last week, and as we are unthankful, as we'll see in our next illustration. I'm going to pass over an illustration that I want to spend more time on next week. And I want to go to the illustration we saw already this morning. Envy again in 1 Samuel chapter 18, which you've already read. Let's look at that. 1 Samuel chapter 18. David has just delivered Israel from the Philistines. It must have been an embarrassing thing for the Israelites, and more so for Saul. Now, anybody remember what was special about Saul's looks? It says he was good looking, but there's something else that's said about him. Anybody remember what it is? He was head and shoulders taller than anyone else in Israel. Head and shoulders? Head and shoulders what? 18 inches maybe? Maybe a little more? The guy was pretty tall. I don't know. I'm guessing at least 7 feet. I don't know. Maybe more. He is the guy. But they had this embarrassing thing going on with the Philistines. They had this two mountain thing going on. And the Philistines wanted to dominate the Israelites. And they were at an impasse. For 40 days they were at an impasse. But for 40 days the Israelites had to be embarrassed by this guy named Goliath. See, they weren't just like facing each other, everybody sort of being quiet, maybe sending smoke signals to each other, sticking their tongues out at each other from afar. It wasn't quite like that. The Philistines had a champion, and his name was Goliath. And of course, when you're in two hills like this, and you have a brook in between, you don't want to attack the other, be the one to attack. In war, the best way to fight, if you can do it, is to try to get the enemy to attack you on ground of your choosing. If you can defend yourself well, the enemy runs themselves against your arrows and your spears and your pikes, while you defend yourself behind a solid line, and you win the battle just by staying there and doing nothing except defending yourself. The enemy runs himself against you, and you survive it, and they lose. And one of the ways you don't want to lose in war is a failed charge. You don't want to do that. Because if your charge fails, you know what happens next? The enemy comes back out from behind their defenses, and they start chasing you. And guess what? They're rested because they're behind their defenses, and you're not. You've been charging. You've been running. You're tired. They're not. This is a way to really lose a battle. And so no one wanted to attack the other. You had the brook in between. It's always hard to attack across water. You're pretty defenseless, especially if the other side has arrows. It's hard to defend yourself when you're going through water. So you have these two hills, Philistines here, Israelites here. Every morning for 40 days, Goliath gets out there and he embarrasses everybody. And he's got to be the biggest embarrassment to Saul. Because if anybody should have fought this big guy Goliath, it would have been Saul. He was the biggest guy. And for 40 days, he's hiding just like everybody else. Well, along comes David. Along comes David, and he solves the problem, does he not? And it talks about a great slaughter, and I believe it was. Because after Goliath gets killed, the Philistines just start running. Now that's the way that you really want to fight, right? If I'm ever in a battle, that's the one I want to be in. The other guy's running, and I'm chasing. There's no chance anything's going to happen to me. This is, I get a kick out of this. This is how cats especially are, right? Most animals that are that prey on other animals are kind of like this, right? You turn and face a cat, and the cat looks like it could get hurt. Cats back off a little bit. Depending on how hungry they are, they might still come at you. But cats love prey that just runs and runs away. They love that. They can't get hurt. They can only hurt. Well, that was the nature of this tremendous victory over the Philistines that David had produced. That would not have happened without this shepherd boy with a sling. And everybody's happy, right? Especially Saul. No more embarrassment from that Goliath guy. Oh, but he's got another embarrassment going on. We just read it, didn't it? Didn't we? Yeah, they're coming home. Verse 7. So the women sang as they danced and said, this is 1 Samuel 18:7, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. Then Saul was very angry, and the saying displeased him, and he said, they have ascribed to David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed only thousands. Now what more can they have but the kingdom? Saul apparently, in his self-serving, in his pride, in his inability to actually serve the children of Israel. If he was really serving the children of Israel, he'd be thrilled, right? If he was serving them. But it turns out his position as king was they're supposed to serve him. He's supposed to be the big guy, the hot shot. If he was really serving them, he'd be thrilled, right? We got rid of the Philistines. Who cares if they ascribe to David 10,000? They can ascribe to him millions and me none. Whatever, the Philistines are gone. Let's get back to business. But, oh no, he's more concerned about a few people saying Saul killed his thousands, David his 10,000s, than he was, apparently, about the Philistine. Apparently. Now, we sit here today and we say, boy, that doesn't make any sense. But it made sense to Saul at the time. That's what envy does. It makes sense to us at the time. And look what Saul was filled with. He was filled with pride, and he was filled with ingratitude. They have ascribed to David 10,000s, and to me they've only sacrificed only thousands. Now what more can they have, can he have, but the kingdom? Now, that envy, as we know, did not just destroy Saul. Not just Saul. It destroyed the friendship between Jonathan and David. Think about it here for a moment, my friends. Think about it. Have you known any case where envy destroyed a friendship? I know of cases like that. Just based on pure envy. That's all. And Saul here could have had himself a tremendous ally. And I actually believe that Saul would have been a successful king militarily. He certainly would have been a good king economically if he would have gone by God's law. But militarily, I think he could have been a very good king. He winds up losing to the Philistines and getting himself killed and all of his sons killed in one battle later on in the book of 1 Samuel. And I believe, and at that time, Saul and David were at odds. It looks to me like Saul was envious, and he spent so much of his time trying to kill David. You remember, read 1 Samuel. Saul had a bigger problem with David, who had done so much for him, than he did with the Philistines. I'm going to say, hey, if you're one of Saul's advisors, Saul, can we take a time out for a minute, Saul? Can we do this? Can we kind of leave David alone for a while and maybe deal with the people that really want to destroy us? Last time I checked, Saul, if you could talk to him like this, Saul, last time I checked, David's not trying to kill everybody. He's not trying to destroy us. He's not trying to carry us off into slavery. I think the Philistines are. Saul, can we give David a break and concentrate on the Philistines. But no, we have to kill David so we can feel better about Saul and his thousands and David his 10,000 or whatever. Envy, destroying Saul's kingdom. Envy. And when Saul and his sons get killed in a final battle with the Philistines, Saul at that point is still trying to destroy David. And I believe, I don't think I'm playing games with the text here at all this morning, at all, that if Saul would have had David for an ally, if he would have had him for a military commander, for a military attaché, if you will, or advisor, that Saul does not lose to the Philistines. I mean, really, think about it. Why would you want to chase away the guy who had helped you win the greatest battle against the Philistines ever? Why do you want to destroy him? But no, Saul has to destroy David, and then he himself ultimately gets destroyed. My friends, this morning, there are other passages that I wanted to look at. We don't have time. I wanted to look at the example there of Christ. There's three more examples that I want to look at later. The example of Christ and the example of Jephthah. Interestingly enough, this morning, I have to tell you that part of the inspiration for my message came from Pastor Paul Michael Raymond, who taught on the same topic, the topic of envy. And he got it out of the book of Judges with Jephthah. If you get a chance, those sermons are, three sermons on Jephthah are really terrific, especially the one that he preached last Sunday. So that was part of my inspiration here, to spend more time on this. I want to talk more about Jephthah, and I want to talk more about what was really happening with Christ. And the reason why I want to talk more about Christ is, and we'll do this more, but I want to wrap it up by saying this. We look at those scribes and Pharisees, those chief priests, if you will, like they're some kind of otherworldly type wicked people that aren't made like us. After all, we love Christ. And we believe in Jesus. Not like those people. Those people didn't believe in Jesus. They're just bad, wicked people. But my friends, what about the reasons why they killed Christ? What about that envy problem? Are we not just as susceptible to envy as are they? And I want to wrap it up this morning by asking yourself, how many times have you thought about your neighbor who doesn't deserve the good things that they have? And it's envy in your heart. How many times have you plotted? Have you ever done this? Have you plotted against someone else to try to destroy them, or at least thought about, considered plotting against them because they have something that they don't deserve? And it's not going to help you if your plans were carried out, but it is going to help destroy them. My friends, understand one thing. If you do not go to war, get this through our heads this morning. If you do not, you and I do not go to war against envy, we will entertain it, and it will act out. And it can only be destructive. Who are you envying this morning? Right now. Who? Get rid of it. Give it up. How do you give it up? You give it up the way Saul should have. Saul should have been thankful that God gave him David, because he sure wasn't getting anything done with the Philistines on his own. He had 40 days to do it. The first thing he should have done is offered a sacrifice. Thank you, Lord, for giving us deliverance. Thank you for this young man, David. The antidote to envy, I believe, is thankfulness. Without thankfulness, envy will have its way with us. Shall we pray? Oh Lord, we tend to play patsy-watsy and to entertain wickedness in our hearts. May we not do this. may we not ever entertain wickedness. This horrific thoughts and ideas of envy. Wanting what our neighbor has. Wanting to destroy the reputation or the even the lives of our neighbor as we saw here this morning. Deliver us from that evil, we pray. Because it's an evil that we embrace at times. May we hate it for the destructive force that it is. For the confusion and every evil work that it embraces. May we choose instead the wisdom from above. Pure, peaceable, gentle, easily entreated, full of mercy, full of good works. Good works, not evil. We pray in the name of Christ, our Savior and Lord. Amen.